intertextual cardboard experience.
Hello and welcome to Intertextual Cardboard Experience, where we're really excited to welcome Primetime 29th guest, Matthew Dunstan. How are you doing today, Matthew?
I'm very well, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. This is going to be, all conversations are fun conversations, but this one can kind of bridge some gaps between a couple sets of conversations that I've had. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, hoping I can close the circle, I guess. You know,
Yes.
if you're trying to hunt us all down, you've managed to find us all now. And
Well, I'm sure there's more that I can keep going down like the web
yes.
or the chain, but yeah, no, this is going to be awesome. So yeah, I'll definitely just start off with like an introductory question, but then we'll get into the main parts. And
Sure.
my newest iteration of my first question is just having you reflect on either an early memory that made you fall in love with gaming, and or I'll throw the and or in a recent memory that made you kind of re-fall in love with gaming.
Well, I think the very early one is much easier for me because I haven't really played a lot of games that recently, ironically. Yeah, for me, it was kind of all about family. I have very clear memory of my aunt, who was sort of the fun aunt when I'm one of three brothers, three boys, and she would always come up and visit us. We didn't live in the same town. And, you know, the moment she would get off out of her car, like we'd be dragging her to the room to like start playing games, and we played a lot of traditional card games. But I remember her teaching me chess when I was about five, and she had this small little cardboard portable chess set. And I remember this, I even remember where it was. It's funnily enough, it's actually the city where I now live. I didn't live there then. And I, after this moment of sort of learning the rules, and she gave me a book to kind of, you know, they had like chess problems and things, or just like teaching you more. When I was at school, I would pester the teachers who were like looking after all the children, like on the playground, who were supposed to just be looking out at the kids, but I'd be pestering them to play chess with me on this little chess set, you know. So I think that's a one very clear memory, but this aunt, Beth, who definitely, you know, kindled the love of a lot of games. We played a lot of traditional card games in Australia. We have you might be familiar with Euchre, maybe. I'm not sure, which I think is a little bit bigger in the States, but there's a variant called 500, which is for four players, which I have learned over time is, I think, most popular in Australia. And yeah, we would play that all the time. And even a bit later, actually, she, you know, even had more of an influence in a way, is that her son had played Magic, and that was how I got into Magic, which is also a huge influence on me in terms of gaming. So yeah, I think that I was fortunate to grow up in a family where maybe we didn't play like sort of modern board games, but the idea of playing games was certainly normal and fun and enjoyed regularly.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's always like I think a lot of these good memories are tied to family or you know, like friends, of course. But yeah, that's awesome that you had that one particular aunt that was being like constantly hounded by you just to play games.
Oh
So.
yeah, she would have been on a train for like 4 hours or something to get to our place, and then, you know, immediately we'd be like making up games in the pool, like that she would play with us, and she's quite a bit older than us, so like, you know, it was she was really just encouraging us. And even now, she's, you know, I give her copies of my games, and you know, she's very kind. No, I kind about them. I don't think she really, you know, she doesn't play them, she doesn't, it's sort of beyond, but she just certainly appreciates it and is really nice about it. So yeah, it's nice that I can kind of share that with her, like that full journey, I guess.
Oh, that's really sweet. And I know you said she might not necessarily like play them, any of them. Are there any of your games that you know that she has played and potentially kind of like latched on to?
That's a good question. That's actually, it's a bit shameful that I haven't played. So we'll get into, you know, I haven't lived in Australia for a long time. I was away for a long time. So I've got to remedy that probably. I think there's a few games of mine that she definitely could play. But actually, I don't think We may have tried to play Relic Runners, my very first game, very long time ago, but I don't have a very strong memory of it. So I'm not. Maybe it didn't happen, or but she's actually a big Scrabble player, really. So we play Scrabble a lot when we and she just absolutely trounces me because I'm not on that scene, really. So.
Not on the competitive Scrabble scene.
Oh no, I don't have all the two-letter words memorized. That you're at a significant disadvantage once you all these sort of seeming apparently they're real words. I mean, they seem made up to me, but yeah.
As long as it's in the Scrabble dictionary, it flies, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That is awesome. So yeah, we kind of alluded to it. So you moved back to Australia, and one set of interviews that I had was with Brett, Trevor, and David as kind of part of this Cambridge cabal. So I've heard, stories. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and again, speaking of memory, the talks I had with them are a bit ago, but I did try to jog my memory a little bit that I wasn't coming into this completely super foggy, but kind of the start of that, like the meetup and the design group was you and Brett, and then Trevor would came in, and then David as well. So I've heard, kind of the stories of like the them entering and Brett's take, but what's, I guess, maybe either your story or maybe just a story of that group that you want to share and talk about.
Oh gosh. I mean you're talking about such a long period of time. I mean, in the end, the group start well, I mean, Brett and I started meeting in 2011 and I left Cambridge in 2020. And I mean the group is still going in some ways, although Brett and Trevor still live near Cambridge, so they meet up regularly. So yeah, it's a really long period of time and it sort of covers, pretty much most of my career as a game designer. I think early on, it's sort of interesting to think about where it came from because it reminds me a little bit of like you hear a lot about this idea of if you want to get good at something or if you want to do something, you have to kind of be prepared to do it for maybe like 3 years before anything happens. I guess it's not in the case of getting a game published or signed, but in terms of having that group kind of take off, I remember really for the first 2, 2.5 years, it was just four people. It was Brett and myself, and we had started. I maybe Brett said this, but I basically stalked him over the internet to find out. He used to have an amazing game design blog, and I mean, this was back in 2009, 2010. This was so there wasn't a lot of writing being done about game design, and it was really fantastic stuff. And I keep asking him. I hope he hasn't lost them because I think they would stand the test of time now. And yeah, I had found this blog even when I still lived in Australia, and I was like, oh wow. And I knew that Brett was in the UK, and I knew I was moving to the UK, and I messaged him, and it just turned out that he lived in Cambridge, so it was sort of perfect, and we could start meeting up. But it was just the two of us, and then Andrew Sheeran and Tom Morgan Jones, who are from a company called Terrible Games, maybe well known or infamously known for a game called War on Terror. They sort of specialize in satirical and styles of games, but really talented folks. It was just the four of us for 2.5 years. And the interesting thing also was, in some ways, it was this beautiful, really lucky kind of circumstance in that Andrew and Tom were completely up for anything, which is great in a playtesting group, obviously. But they still had the kind of acumen of designers. So they had that kind of analytical mind, that kind of background, that context. But they also didn't bring anything themselves most of the time. Andrew, like they were just happy to rock up and play our stuff. Sometimes the problem when you have a lot of designers in one group is if you need four people to play a game, well, that's three people whose games aren't being played, and the whole thing is built on reciprocity. I always screw up this word. We're playing, giving time to each other, basically. So yeah, we were really fortunate, but we never really thought. Looking back, I'm so glad we persisted. You could go like, "Oh, there's only four people showing up, or is this really worth it?" But we were kind of diehard. We'd meet every week, and then it would. And then after that, I think it. You just people hear about it, and Cambridge was this town which has so many. It's a really fortunate kind of place. It's a university town. you get so many people coming from all around the world. Trevor and David, great examples from Canada and the US respectively, coming. So and me from Australia, of course. So you have this great mix, and of course the university, it attracts like broad range of people from different backgrounds and different interests. And that kind of mix is great to have, I think, in a game design group. And I think it that was one of the factors that led to just having that, that really diverse mix. And I think somehow I don't know. I wish, I think I like to think we had some sort of ethos that sort of guided what was going on. I'm not sure if in your I didn't actually listen to the conversation with Brett. He probably wasn't as he's quite direct now in terms of playtesting. I'm not sure if he was as direct there, but I think there was a thing about, that you just sort of say it how it is. It's not personal. I think there's a sort of an efficiency to that to help people improve their games, that you're not just sort of, playing it each week and it's still not working. And and I think it helped that Brett had a, his first game had been signed and published. So there's a bit of experience already in the group about how that kind of process could work. So I think you just had all the right elements there. The only story I really, and Brett probably didn't say this, and it's not specifically about the group, but I guess it's about me working with Brett, is that he was confused as my father once when we were pitching at a fair. Somebody at a dinner said, "Oh, do you always bring your dad to conventions with you or something, like to pitch games?" Which
Be happy about.
I didn't. Oh,
It's fine. No, I think my headphones died, but hopefully it'll go.
oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I didn't hear that, and I also didn't hear that early on that you had kind of like, stalked him out, either, but
Well, yeah,
I.
we actually met at Essen Spiel, not in Cambridge, in fact. He said that he was going to this fair, and I had just moved in October. I mean, I think I had only been in the UK 3 weeks, and I went to Essen for the first time, and met him there actually. So yeah, he was very trusting, I guess. Thankfully.
No, it's awesome. Now I have like at this point in time, who knows, maybe future numbers will grow, but I have four perspectives, four members, and four kind of like little bits of stories. But yeah, not that you have to, but I think you'd get a kick out of listening to that
No,
episode with
I will. I
Brett.
will go
So.
back. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I have to hear the stories from another point of view. Maybe I've missed things.
I know. Now I have to go back and listen. I like re-listening to them. Just all the stories that they make me smile quite a bit.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I kind of did, and yeah, actually, just from an ordering of when I talked to people, if I'm not mistaken, the first person that I talked to was Trevor, and kind of like the series or the trilogy, as I called it, was like collabstraction. So it was kind of thinking about obviously collaboration and then just like levels of abstraction in design and like how that ranges. But as a lot of your designs and a lot of their designs wind up being with somebody else or at least one other person, not and you do solo designs too. And I know that that might be a little bit different. I think Trevor might almost exclusively do co-designs now, and I think that's kind of what David is moving towards as well. But I know you do a little bit of both. But one of the things I had everybody do was kind of come up with a like a name or a title for themselves that described them and their role in like a collaborative like team setting.
It's a good question. I've actually thought about this. If you ever get a chance to get Bruno Cathala on, he, I think, wrote about it quite well, in that he sort of describes in every partnership as a designer, he becomes not a different person, but he takes on these different roles, very much to complement, depending on how he can complement his partner. I would say I'm probably, if I was to give a name, just one word, I'd say like initiator, probably. I think my primary skill set, or at least something I'm very good at, is having lots of ideas, which is not unique to designers, but being able to make the very first prototype of a new idea. In some ways that's it's a lot harder to go from zero to one than from one to two in terms of iterations. And I think, yeah, just the ability and I guess almost the efficiency of which I can do that for several games reasonably quickly. And it just enables them to get onto the table and to be tested. And actually, a lot of the way I work with Brett in particular, who's the person I've designed the most with, is often I will have an idea pretty much almost independent of Brett. And I will just make a first prototype myself without any input from him. Maybe we'll have a conversation or two, but and then I'll put it in front of him and we'll play it. And that'll be his kind of first impression of it. And then we'll go from that. It's more about that. I know when I have an idea, it's like, oh, this is a game that I can imagine Brett would like to work on, or that could fit, what he would like to do. I think we know each other well enough by now. So, but I know that it doesn't really go the other way because Brett doesn't really work that way. Or for him, it's a much harder process. He has a lot of ideas, but they stay in his notebook, and they could be really great ideas. I know a lot of designers like that. Conversely, and I'm not probably very good at the very end of the process. I'm not particularly good at the kind of editorial or development or the last bits of development, which are like you have to be very keen-eyed and you're getting all the details right and changing ones to twos or twos to threes or whatever. I mean, I can certainly do it, but it's not my strength. Whereas I really think it is very much Brett's strength. I think it's one reason that we've worked so much together and worked so well together, because I think we're a very strong complement at sort of different stages of the process.
That's awesome. And kind of based on like what you were saying and something I had in my mind, I'm actually kind of jumping ahead in my thoughts a little bit, but I think it fits really well here. So I guess kind of one of my questions is, so you'll design a lot with Brett, you design with other designers and you design by yourself and just in general, and this is kind of one of the things that I'll probably touch on like next and like the next section is, I mean, you've just been designing a lot of games in general. Like, I mean, throughout, you mentioned your first design back in 2013 and then the first few years, good handful of games, but kind of really took off after that. So in your process of, coming up with ideas, I mean, obviously I'm not 100% on the ins of the publisher side. Are you being approached by, different people for various reasons? But when it comes to your ideas, how do you know whether it's going to be one that you want to bring and work on with Brett or do something else with? Like, what's kind of the decision process there for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think my default is probably to work with other people if possible. Although even that is not completely true. So, I guess there's a bit of a difference even in my own kind of career. The first part, which I'd say that, until say 2020 or 2021, I was part-time. I was, even in the very early stages of this, no sense of like making a living from it. You're just enjoying doing it. So I think through most of that part, I would have always gone co-design if you can, because my strong belief is that not only are you more likely to finish a design and get it to a sellable state if you're working with someone else, but it'll also be a better game. Working with someone else will always make it a better game. So like that was my default. And so actually in some ways I was probably quite self-selecting on the ideas, and in terms of ideas that suit Brett, I think it was more there was just a style of game. And if you look at the games we've made together, they are broadly in a similar kind of space of sort of family plus kind of strategy games, fairly low luck, European Euro style sort of mechanism. So even if you look at our kind of games, you can kind of see, yeah, I can kind of see what that kind of vibe is. You could always, in other single designers would make that kind of same game. So, whenever I'd have an idea like in that kind of genre or that kind of weight, sort of thing, I go like, oh yeah, Brett would be that would make sense to work with Brett. Some other games were with other collaborators. Sometimes they would come to me with an idea and, we'd work with that, like Pioneer Days with Chris Marling is one example. Chris is also part of the Cambridge group. He really had that core idea, and then he kind of approached me and we kind of worked on that together. And every so often, I think there was an idea, and this was probably only something I got a little bit of a conscious sense later. I'd have an idea where I'm just like, this is really a game, not exactly for me, but it's so close to my own loves in gaming. It's sort of strange. I probably don't make as many games. How do I say this? My favorite games are not of the same style of the games I publish, the games I enjoy to play. Partly, and they fall into two broad categories. One is kind of medium strategic Euros. I like the ones of the Italian style of like Simone Luciani. Grand Austria Hotel is one of my favorites, Hansa Teutonica. And I've tried design games like that. I loved Steppenfeld for a lot long period. And I've just never been able to do it for whatever reason. It just gets too not like complex. There's too many interlocking things, and my brain just doesn't it wants to kind of simplify it. And I think Brett's been an influence on me. He's even more about simplifying things. The other style of game is kind of games coming from Magic, games with lots of cards, variable powers. And for me, like Race for the Galaxy is my favorite game of all time to play. And so I just keep trying to make Race for the Galaxy. And it's a difficult genre. Not that it's hard to design, but I think my standards are quite high. Like I know that like I'm not just gonna make yet another game. It has to be worthwhile. And so sometimes I know, especially in that genre, if I have an idea, and that was the case with Monumental, for instance, where I had that core deck building idea, the 3x3 grid, and I knew it worked. And I knew it was so close to what I enjoyed that I was like, I'm going to work on this myself because there are those rare times where I'm like, actually, now I want to make that game that, like, I don't want to kind of compromise on things because I want to kind of control that kind of creative process. Getting back to the start of the answer is more recently in the last 2 or 3 years, I guess that focus has shifted a little bit because now I'm full time game. I'm very fortunate enough to make a living from game design, but you do actually start. Sadly, having to think a little bit about the economics. And there are some times where I'll think like, I could co-design, or could I just make it myself? And and you just get more money. I think that's a bit irrational, actually. I still actually believe that, if you were to be strictly kind of efficiency and capitalism and all this sort of stuff, I think you would still actually do better by collaborating realistically, like from a kind of return point. There's also a thing of I think of it as like you're throwing darts at a dartboard, and the more darts you throw, i.e. games you release, the more likelihood you'll get one that will sell well. And that's kind of where the game is at in terms of like the finances of game design right now. It's not you can do well from releasing lots of games, to a moderate success, but it really helps to have one or two that do really well, that kind of hit. And it's so hard to tell. It's really hard to tell what's going to go well. Publishers don't know. Depends on all these different factors. So you may as well throw more darts. So I think more recently, yeah, it's. I'm still collaborating, and I really enjoy like starting new things with new designers. I've made a few new games with some Australian designers I've met since I've come back. So I'll always keep doing that. But I think it's. There's like another consideration than just what is kind of the best thing creatively. Which, is an interesting kind of struggle that I'm still kind of getting used to. It's a new way of thinking about how to do game design.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it definitely makes like a lot of sense. There's obviously a lot of considerations when it comes into game design, and for your case, like doing it full time and like who you're working with and when, and yeah. I like that a lot though. Okay. So another person, designer that you've collaborated with is actually the last person who I talked to, and that is Rory Muldoon. And so I think now we'll talk a little bit about get into that side of the conversation, or that conversation I just had with Rory, and then getting into Postmark a little bit too. But I actually, well, I listened to that episode. I listened to all the episodes at least two, three times when I like go back and try to come up with like timestamps, and then I just listened to it again today because there were a lot of things that Rory mentioned that he wanted me to either like mention to you or ask you. So I had them screenshotted. I'm like, I could just go back and like look at the times for them, but I listened to it again and then made my document right away after that. But nonetheless, from what Rory said, his kind of introduction to you was in some live streams that you were doing around the pandemic time. So first off, I'm supposed to tell you that he wants them to come back. But a kind of like furthermore, one of the things that I was kind of thinking about those live streams then too is that I think a lot of times when you are teaching something or you are internalizing something to the point where you write about it, like you mentioned with Brett's blogs, or you're speaking on it in a live stream or whatever it might be, it takes kind of like a new conceptualization of those thoughts in the first place, and also like it's a learning process for you too. So I guess the question then is, what is something that was like a really good takeaway for you from like making all of those kind of design-based live streams?
That's a good question. I think that I guess the takeaway, I'm not sure if I took away so much in terms of my own design practice. I think it probably subconsciously, yes, as you said, it helps kind of crystallize certain ideas. I think doing interviews and podcasts also help that in ways as well. And I think I just realized that I really enjoyed it. And I think actually, I realize how important community is ultimately to me, to game design. That was, I probably started doing that really because I just didn't have a community. During the pandemic, my wife is Czech, and I went to Prague, and I ended up staying in Prague for 3 years. And suddenly, I was sort of cut off from the different, the regular sort of game design community. I mean, as a lot of people were anyway at that time. And for me, streaming was trying to rekindle that sense of community. And I think I really strongly realized that, it's the same with the playtesting group. For me, the reason we kept doing it is because it was social. It wasn't actually about testing games, really. Yes, we were sort of friends because of that shared interest, but over time it becomes so much more than that. And that's how these things get sustained for so long. It's not because it's work, it's because it's fun. And I think I lost that a bit in the pandemic. And so actually streaming was a really nice way to, it's, a different sense of community, but it was still a really strong feeling from that. And I do miss it, actually, in some ways. It's a bit, I've struggled for a long time. So my previous career was a scientist, so I'm actually quite used to teaching in some ways. I did some of that and public speaking and giving seminars and all that sort of thing. So I think I had that kind of skill set, but I've struggled for a long time to think about how to kind of contribute to like game design in the kind of community. I'm very fortunate. I have a lot of experience, and it's finding a way to kind of share that in a way that I somehow, just as I said, like the playtesting has to be fun. Whatever this other thing I decide to do has to kind of also somehow be fun, because all the things I've sort of tried, and as enjoyable as the streaming was, I never quite got into the kind of groove of like really, it took a lot more out of me than I think I got from it, even though I did get things from it. It just wasn't maybe the right kind of form for me. I used to write quite a bit on Twitter. That's died. Blue Sky's got a bit back. So I have a kind of a blog that's a bit semi-dead. I've tried a lot of these different things, and I would love to find a sustainable way to kind of have that community around game design. And shares and because I think, like, not it is not to kind of toot my own horn, but I think that there's value in what I can share ultimately. Like there are, even if it is just one small thing that changes how someone thinks about something or gives someone a help up, and I know I benefited so much from that when I was a beginning designer, so I would like to find the best way to be able to do that again somehow.
Oh, cool. Well, when that happens, you'll let me know first, and then I'll let Rory know. I'll be like, guess what? We got
It's
it.
funny you talk about that. I went to a convention last year in Australia, actually a new convention. I'm not sure if you know the podcast Board Game Barbecue. I'll give them a shot. Yeah, so they're fantastic guys, and they ran their first sort of large scale convention in Sydney last year called PlayCon. And I went along and it was amazing. I really, really enjoyed it. And I was surprised, actually, how many people came up to me and said, hey, when are you going to next put the thing on your blog, or where's the streams gone? Because I, sometimes, I mean, maybe you can empathize a little bit, running a podcast as well, is that sometimes you sort of feel a little bit like you're doing all this work and it's a little bit out into the ether. Like, is anyone listening really? Like, is it because you don't, the metrics don't even necessarily reflect like what's happening in reality. And so I felt that way sort of streaming. You'd be streaming to like three people, and they're the three people who show up every time, and I'm glad they did, and I love them. But it's like you kind of feel like, okay, why am I doing this? But it was that, yeah, there's random people sort of saying, oh, like, oh, I didn't know you watched the streams. Okay, so I think there was they traveled a little bit, and also I'm terrible at promoting anything or like telling people to come and watch stuff. That's obviously part of the kind of job which I also kind of suck at. So anyway, it's it t t TBD, basically. TBD.
I feel the promo stuff. It's funny. So you kind of mentioned, the community element, and that was something that was like lacking in those years, and that's why you wanted to like do that. And for me, yeah, it's community. I love board games, obviously. I'm doing a board game based podcast, and there are many elements that wind up getting to be just nice and fun for me. I get to talk to like the coolest game designers in the business and have like these awesome conversations, and yeah, like of course I want other people to listen to it too, but it's like that self promo stuff or figuring out the metrics to make it hit like kind of with like why certain games do or don't or whatever. It's just like, I don't know. But nonetheless, I like kind of what you mentioned with the design group too. Like you persisted, and that's, hey, as long as people want to talk to me, and as long as people listen in, my voice will exist in the ether. So
And as long as you, and it sounds like you enjoy it, that's the other thing. Like, yeah, what if you're going to do it anyway and you're getting so much, then you'll keep doing it, and people will eventually find it. It's just a question of time,
Yeah, like I said, yeah, it's been great, and I like chatting with people about it, like people that do like interact with it and everything. Yeah, that's very, very fun. So I'm glad that this is kind of like an outlet for me. But yeah, again, once you venture back in whatever way, let me know. Speaking of, you said scientist previously. Is your mug science E?
Oh, it is. It is a periodic table mug.
Oh, nice.
Actually, my daughter, who's 10 months, she currently re she sees me drinking it, and I've been reading out the elements to her, and she seems to enjoy it. I'm not sure how much she's. I'm trying to sort of, subtly, subliminally put that information in, obviously.
Well, it's got a good look, and if you're going to like be able to kind of trick her into liking science, that's a good way to do
You
it.
don't
So
have to trick people into liking science. It's natural. You don't have to trick
that.
people.
Yes, I agree. Oh, awesome. Okay, I don't know if like the order of these is going to make the most sense, but yeah, we Rory mentioned Postmark Games. The most recent project that you put out just wrapped up, 52 Realms Adventures, that had a successful crowdfunding Kickstarter project that ended like what, yesterday maybe 2 days ago.
Yeah, Sunday evening. Yeah, UK time.
So that just wrapped up, and it talked to Rory about some of the kind of like changes from your previous designs for Postmark, in it being a little bit bigger. So it's now a two sheet game. It uses a standard deck of 52 cards as the randomizer. Also uses those cards for particular places and functions within kind of like the space on the two sheets that you're doing. And kind of because of that, he mentioned that there might be the possibility of kind of challenges and things like that, but it is an exclusively kind of like solo game, whereas your previous games could be one to infinite, right? For the most part, yeah. But yeah, so again, Sometimes I have questions. I guess Rory just said that he wanted you to kind of maybe elaborate on some of the solo specificity or like that being that. Like that's what this game is, and he said that you would talk to me more about it. So
Expand on that then. Yeah, it's interesting. We had wanted to make a playing card game for a really long time. I think when we set up Postmark, it wasn't really necessarily just to be about roll and rights with some dice. I think, you know, it was a little bit taking something from like Cheap Ass Games, which are an older publisher who did really what we were doing. It's about using any kind of ordinary components you might have lying around your house. And so I think very early on, we knew playing cards, and I think we really liked the aesthetic of it. I love playing cards just generally as traditional card games. And for a long time, we probably persevered on games which were closer to that kind of roll and write, flip and write kind of style, using the cards as sort of a randomizer effectively, which would allow for a game of a similar style and multiplayer and all that sort of thing. But we hit a lot of dead ends, tried a lot of different prototypes, actually, a lot of different ideas, which is sort of unusual. With Postmark, there haven't been too many discarded ideas, actually. I mean, that probably speaks to the, I mean, it's something I do amongst many other things, and Rory to a certain degree as well. So, you know when you have a good idea, but we've always kind of been able to develop it. But this was different because we had this kind of end goal that we really wanted to get to. Usually we're not setting like, oh, I'm going to make a hiking game. It's no, I we start with this mechanism and then kind of grows into that. And I think it was the moment, and like Flip Town had come out, I think. I don't know exactly what year that came out. And I think there was this moment where I'd sort of been bashing my head against the wall for a long time with it. And we sort of got to a point where I'm like, the next game has to be this card game. We can't like keep pushing it back. And so I'm probably put a little bit more effort, and I just sort of realized that for us, the problem is that our games, we try and make them sort of as accessible as possible. We try not to have really busy sheets, because part of that is also the kind of aesthetics of it. We want, I think, and Rory probably talked about it, it's about, we want to make a game that's beautiful before you start playing and beautiful at the end. And I think some roll and writes, and that's perfect, that's their style, but they become very busy, they become very spreadsheety, very at different stages, and we never want to do that. But the problem with the playing cards is that you suddenly have to define what like 13 numbers mean and four suits mean and what all those possibilities are. And of course they allow for games like Flip Time with that amazing diversity and kind of detail and lots of different strategies and kind of heavier experiences. Fantastic, but it's not for us. And we'd been trying to do what in the end I realized was probably a bit of an impossible task, make a kind of Postmark style game, but with this card-based randomizer. And then I don't know exactly when, I just sort of realized that we hadn't really thought about the cards as they're not just a randomizer. I mean, they are a physical. I mean, the problem we always run into is that, we're kind of constrained by you only have one sheet of paper or two sheets. And you have a die or something, but you don't really have like playing pieces. You can't have like tokens, or you can't have chips, or you can't have all these event cards or whatever. And then you're like, hold on, there are 52. I mean, that's effectively 52 components that you suddenly have to use in a game. And I think it was that just realization just kind of completely changed the task. And it's like once you think of them as game objects rather than just this like hit a number, give me a random result thing, which you could just get a computer to do. Then it actually changes what you can do with a print and play game. And from there, it was actually a very quick process. And I mean, of course, there's design there, and there was a good idea of having the cards represent different things, and you could just arrange them around the edge of the sheet to kind of do that elegantly. But once we had that core idea, and I think the other thing was probably finally get there. I think there maybe for me, or I'm not sure if Rory agreed, there was probably a bit of a resistance to not do a kind of usual RPG dungeon crawly kind of game, because we've done pretty well making games that are a bit more realistic, a bit outside of the kind of normal game affair, so to speak. Although of course natural themed games are very popular as well right now, so it's not to say that we were doing something completely new, but I think I was like wondering, oh, will our audience really like that? It's a bit, suddenly it's a bit of a turn to something a bit more geeky or a bit more traditionally geeky. But It was also the point of just realizing, hold on, this kind of works perfectly, actually. Rory had a really good, like a kind of artistic aesthetic in mind already, which you can see in the game clearly. And so once I kind of got over that reticence and we had that idea of the it just made a product. And in the end, it kind of looks like, oh, it's not that it's obvious, but it's like such, it must have been such a clear idea. It seems so clean, but it came through a lot of difficulty or just banging your head against wrong things. But now that we have it, and kind of, I think the Kickstarter are interesting for us. We're really lucky that, I mean, doing print play games, you don't have a financial risk. So the Kickstarter is, we're not usually going to fail. We have a kind of a big enough audience now that, and we don't have huge costs or upfront costs. So it's not so much about, is the campaign going to succeed? But in some ways, it's about just getting people's feedback. Like, what do they think? And what was really nice was that realizing just how well the whole game, the whole package kind of resonates with folk. I think maybe more than any game, actually, people were already talking about, oh, I can imagine what this could be in the game, or I could do this, or what about this? And I think it's when you get those comments, you realize actually, like, that, you're onto something, because, that's something we really encourage in Postmark as well, like, community generated content. Already, even before the campaign is finished, people in our Discord were already designing new characters, which I think is a first, probably. So I think that shows that it was the right kind of call, and I'm really glad that people have sort of latched on to it. And I think we were a little bit worried about the solo only thing, and I guess that some of our community haven't backed it, because it just doesn't suit them. That's fine. That being said, a lot of people play our other game solo. I think that's probably one of the most popular ways to play it. So I don't think it's such a stretch that, our existing community quite used to solo games. And I think once we went this thing with them being physical components, well, that you can no longer have a multiplayer game, because how do you share those things? So I think, yeah, we're still kind of thinking a little bit about how people can compare their experiences. I think we were sort of thinking about. And there's a few different thoughts that we can do. And I like the idea of having weekly challenges or even daily challenges, where you maybe have a different rule or a different setup or something. So I think we're definitely, it will be dependent a little bit on the community that kind of grows up around the game and what they kind of want. But I definitely, and there were a few people asking for like a co-op mode. So maybe that might be something we try and develop, because I could imagine something like that, maybe two decks of cards and people playing together. So yeah, there's I mean, the great thing about it is it feels very it's a very flexible system. I feel very confident that we will be able to make lots of great new content. I hope our community will make great content. And I think we were sort of talking about the promotion thing, and I'm not sure if Rory, I can't remember a reason. I mean, we suck at the self-promotion thing together collectively in the Postmark thing as well. In some ways, I wouldn't. I'm so for, I feel very fortunate how successful we've been, especially given, I think, our deficits in certain skill sets, I would say, one of which is marketing. And with this game especially, I am hopeful, and I think we'll try and do some work on it in the new years to really try and reach out to communities, I think, especially in role playing, because I think, print play in the role play community is really common, and the kind of indie RPG world is really thriving and big. And I would guess a lot of them, well, majority in fact, won't have heard of us or what we're doing. But I think it could be an interesting bridge into that community, because it's not so far away from some of the experiences of that style of game. So it's a way, it's kind of exciting. It's a way to potentially widen the audience or to find a different and I think, then they might find our other games and realize they're fun as well. So yeah, we're really, really glad with how it went. Even though I said, like, we're not worried about this, like, you still like want it to do well, and we're really, just really grateful for everybody who did back it and was so supportive during the campaign.
Yeah. You mentioned just kind of like the way that it all, did come together, and then the way it aesthetically looks from all the different work too. And yeah, I mean, I like the look of all of your games, but that one, it's really slick. I talked a little bit with Rory just kind of about, it was like right after we talked, right after the Kickstarter promo video like launched, and like the page opened up and all that. And yeah, it looks really neat. And then because of that conversation, I also did hop in the Discord. So I've been going on like pretty consistently taking a look at specifically the 52 Realms, subpage. And like, yeah, like you mentioned, people already come up with characters like, oh, you could do this character, you could do that character. And
Yeah, I think it's a really good sign. And I should say the appearance, I mean, to that, I mean, that's all Rory, just to be very, very clear. I think he would never say this, but I didn't realize until we started the company or even after Voyages, is that I actually honestly think Rory's one of the most talented board game illustrators, graphic designers, UX in the industry, full stop. I would put him on, someone on par with someone like Ian O'Toole. I mean, maybe not, it's not a direct comparison, I'm not saying, and I love Ian as well. But I didn't know that really. Like you don't, you sort of, you start these things with somebody you enjoy working with. But I didn't realize my really good fortune in starting a company where you effectively have, like, imagine starting a company where you just have Ian O'Toole as your in-house, illustrator designer, and you get to make the games directly with them. Because that's also really important in that it's iterative, not just the case from the game design point of view, but it's iterative in terms of layout, in terms of illustration about UX. It's like they inform each other at a much earlier part of the process, and that's why it feels so much more cohesive. It's a really powerful way to work. And of course, Rory and Ian have great game designs, knowledge and skills as well. So that, they're coming from a really informed contextual place, and how that can sit and how that can look. And so that is, I'm certain that firstly, it's one of the reasons why we've been successful is Rory's amazing skill set in that way. And really, like, I think he's probably very underrated because he hasn't done a lot of games. And not so many people know about Postmark, that's fine. It's people don't necessarily do print and play, but when you look at his work, as you said, like it and just the range, actually, like, our games all look, relatively different. And so no, I feel extremely fortunate on that point as well.
That's great. That's really cool. Yeah, like you said, just kind of that idea of having that like communication early and consistently too. It is the like that collaboration is that full design process. So that's really neat. Kind of one final question on something that Rory and I talked about a little bit, and you've kind of mentioned a little bit too. Probably before getting to our wrap up questions, which is crazy. It's like already blown past for us. But when I talked to Rory and the idea of like community came up and I had personally seen more content that had come out, more maps and or scenarios that would come out for previous games from Postmark, but I wasn't really tapped into the community. And then I went on the Discord, but Rory talked about how all of like the assets then become available, so you get more like fan made content. There was help with translation, and that's like a really unique side to it too. So, oh, I lied. Actually, I have two questions before the wrap up. Sorry, you're stuck with me like a little bit longer, but we'll go to
No,
this one
it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. No worries at
first.
all.
You're stuck, but one of the things that it kind of made me think of was those games like kind of like video games that have level creators, so like you have that ability to just like have the stuff in it and play with it as like a game player, like you have everything you can kind of go to. And he mentioned that like that's something that the both of you have thought about or talked about a bit too. So just kind of like what like how does that, I mean, obviously you make the design and then you put it out there so it exists, but how does that overall idea kind of like influence your thought of your design in general or what the final product is going to wind up being once people do have it?
It's a good question. I think I'm not sure if we necessarily design with, like fan-made or community-made content in mind. I think we'll always make the decisions that try and. I think I would say probably the kind of like core tenets of what we want in Postmark games just already make them quite, a good match for that kind of content. I think we're, as we say, we're always trying to have sheets which are not too busy. They're a bit more iconographic generally rather than relying on a lot of text, although 52 Realms is a little bit different. And I think those things make them more accessible to people who want to make their own maps. I think we also try to be fairly evocative in the kind of theme, so they kind of suggest things that the players they want to make their own, as we were talking about 52 Realms, that immediately suggest things that people want to make for the game. So no, I don't think, and it certainly was not, obviously, when we started with Voyagers, we didn't think about it at all. And that came about really, really organically, really luckily. We haven't really talked about Voyagers much at all, but it was so, we had 13,000 backers on our first campaign without any, we did no marketing. We just set up, we didn't even really have the company properly. That was such, like it's an event, like it's one of the key events of my game designing career, basically, or like linked with starting Postmark with Rory, obviously. But it not only gave us such a sort of kickstart in terms of like the success of the company and kind of getting known, but it gave us this huge community and the kind of people who were involved with that. I don't know. I don't quite know. I maybe print play just automatically just engendered because you're already making like the consumer is already involved in making the game in some way, even if it's just printing off a sheet from their printer. It just creates a different relationship for a player with the game, I think. And so it just meant that there already was this kind of enthusiasm to kind of be involved in making things. And I think then we were sort of catching up initially with like, oh, what should we provide to allow, but, initially we didn't provide the assets. People were just kind of hacking together things themselves and, sharing it. But with our later releases, and we went back and did that with Voyagers as well, is, okay, well, how can we then release these, asset packs effectively that will help people? And Discord obviously is a big thing of that, of people supporting each other, playtesting their own designs, sharing ways to make the things, to make the files and et cetera. So I think, yeah, to answer the question, I don't think it necessarily influenced the design, but it's certainly something we have in mind. And I think the ability, probably more important, is that we make a game that has the ability to sort of capture the imagination of the players. And that will, obviously lead to people enjoying the game, but also for a subset of those people will lead them to wanting to make things for the game.
Awesome. So I guess kind of, yeah. So my final question here does go with that a little bit. And that's that, again, kind of borrowing from your thoughts, borrowing from Rory's thoughts, there wind up, being in this, print and play and kind of, what Rory differentiated as print at home. So games that are solely intended to be, printed, like there's no other physical, space for them, that it winds up opening up like different design possibilities, and you've mentioned some of them. Rory talked about some of them. I guess what's something that you haven't mentioned throughout the course of this conversation that you find, I'm not necessarily going to say like untapped, because you're still working on it. I'm not asking you to give away secrets for future
No,
designs or
it's
anything
okay.
like that, but like, what's something that you're thinking about when you think about this form that you find, like freeing or opening, or that you're just really interested in continuing to explore it?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. The first thing I'll say, which is slightly not exactly an answer to your question, is that as a company, we find ourselves in a weird position in a way. We started the company probably a lot closer to what you were like, kind of the spirit of your question, which was like, oh, this is kind of experimental, it's a bit indie, we can do anything, we can make these kind of crazy games that are so unlike things that have done before, and it doesn't really matter how they go because obviously we don't have the cost. We're slightly victims of our own success in that That kind of comes with, or we probably put on ourselves those kind of expectations, like, hold on, now we need to sell the games, or we need to, we need to do well, they need to support us, etc. So in a weird way, and also because I guess our first three games especially were sort of very much in the same line of things, it's hard, a bit hard now, because you sort of go like, oh, I could make another game like that, and we know our audience would like it, we know it would do well. Or we hope it would anyway. It would be a good chance it would. It actually gets a bit harder to experiment because you're kind of, you feel like you're taking this risk. And of course it's stupid because, all we're putting in is our time. So I think we have to remind ourselves actually, or we, it's almost, we've been thinking a little bit about how do we communicate to our audience, like which is the kind of experimental bit of us and which is the kind of like, if you like these other games, you'll like this sort of thing. Because I think, and we've tried to do that. We've, and we've done that really with collaborations, things like Battle Card from David and Niels. Completely different game, amazing, and I would say quite experimental in a way in terms of a war game. But completely different from what our audience is used to, really. And there was definitely like a segment of the audience who just has zero interest in that. So I think it's just finding the right balance of that. For me, I think the most exciting thing is, well, I mean, I actually think the exciting thing is that we haven't really explored what's possible, really. I don't think many people have. And I reference things like the indie RPG world because I feel like they have done such a better job of exploring what game experiences you can provide in this kind of way. I think about, this isn't show, I mean, this is almost just a brainstorming with for me, but one thing, for instance, I'm really interested in is coloring in, because obviously that's had a huge resurgence with kind of like meditative kind of mental health benefits of that kind of thing. Obviously, a very good fit with a print and play company. And you imagine, like, well, if we can add a simple game to that, then I think you have a really powerful kind of thing. That's one instance. I would say that's not, it's not really pushing the format of things very much. A few people have done games where, where you really destroy the sheet, cut things up, and I think, or fold things or whatever. And I think that could kind of be interesting. I haven't had a strong idea, which is kind of really went with that. And I think the only other thing is I don't know if we would do it. And I'm only really thinking about it now. And it's something, for example, that Buttonshy does a lot better than us, maybe. But this idea, I'm very into kind of numerical logic puzzles. Sudoku is the best known example of, but there's a whole family of styles of puzzle which are basically, put numbers in a grid or fill in squares or whatever. And there used to be this site, or there still is, in fact, which I now can't remember the name of, but every day they would have a new puzzle put up. And for me, it was such a nice ritual to go and, I'd have a cup of tea and I'd do this puzzle, it'd be, 20 minutes or whatever. And I kind of would love to have provide that experience through Postmark somehow, that each day you get the email with the new sheet, you print it off. It's a short kind of game, has a bit of a, it's a little bit different. And it just, it, I think it's this idea of as games, as also almost meditation or as ritual, that it's not really about, it's not even about challenge or even novelty, actually. An experience I had during the pandemic, for instance, obviously thankfully had a lot more time to play games, and I was living with my wife. It was just the two of us, and we mostly most breakfasts we would play a game that lasts 10 minutes. These are published games. For instance, we played Fantasy Realms probably over 200 times, but we enjoyed it every time. Now, can I say that those 200 games were wildly different? No. They it broadly has the same beats, but that the function of us playing the game wasn't to have this sort of like revolutionary game experience or to like do something we've never done in the game. Of course, if any sort of, actually the nice thing is every so often you pull off some crazy thing that you'll only see once every 100 games. But we'd play other games that didn't have that. We'd play Akaya, which is a kind of abstract tic-tac-toe-esque game from Bruno Cathala, like games which didn't necessarily have that variety. But for us, it was just, it was a part of the day. It was this way of spending time together. It was familiar, it was sort of grounding. And you're almost going through the motions, it's closer to something like meditation. It's not even necessarily providing you really difficult decisions or all the things we think of what games should be doing. And so I kind of would love to do something like that with Postmark somehow. Whether it maybe it is more kind of, I guess maybe there'd be more like puzzles, I don't know. Although I think the difficulty with puzzles is they can be right or wrong. I think I don't really want something that people have to really worry about them being right or wrong. But yeah, it's a very different kind of, and we haven't really done games like that in terms of even like distributing them. Yeah, I think I would love to do something like that as well.
Awesome. Well, I mean, in general, and this is going to be like the final question. There's a lot of things to look forward to from you from the design space, but now we get this whenever it exists, and your return to the blogosphere,
I'm promising too many
and
things.
hey,
I
that's like one of my things. I make people promise stuff.
should.
But no, okay. We are on to the wrap up question. So the second to last question that I have is just kind of a text that is on your mind. So this kind of like opens it up. So it doesn't have to be a board game. It could be something that you're watching, listening to, or reading, something that's just, recent that you have enjoyed for any reason. Or maybe you don't enjoy it. Maybe it's just on your mind.
Oh, should have sent me this question before the thing because I would have. I always were like in the moment, I sort of freed up a bit. Well, I'll go to one favorite, which I just think one podcast I particularly enjoy and continue to enjoy is 99% Invisible. I don't think it's a particularly, well, it looks like you don't know it. So I sometimes think that I just assume that a lot of people know it, but it's broadly about design, but any form of design, basically. And they're sort of 30-minute episodes, and they go into how things were made the way they were, but from a very sometimes it's such a specific and I remember some episodes, for instance, about how the shot clock came into basketball, for instance. There was one episode about that. So they're partly historical, partly you look at the details of things, or how certain cities are designed or why they're designed that way, or all these sort of things. And I find it consistently inspirational, not always directly, but just always interesting. Just for me, always a really easy recommendation. I enjoy it. Yeah, I enjoy it very much. And the other thing recently, relatively recently, being a bit broadly, as having a newborn is sort of like I've sort of lost a certain amount of time. Oh my gosh, how have I forgotten? Sorry, I just have to very. Oh yeah, is Scavenger's Reign,
Oh.
which is a animated television series that I think was maybe originally on Netflix. I don't, or maybe HBO. It's different in each country, but Scavenger's Reign. It's a sci-fi animated series. Beautiful to look at, but the premise and the what they've created in terms of the world and just the, I haven't quite seen something like it or not for some time. Just would really, I won't say much more about it, but I would really recommend it. Even if you're not really a huge sci-fi fan, I would say it's not kind of all like Chrome and robot sort of thing, so I think it's done really, really well. And I would recommend that too.
Awesome. I'll definitely look into that podcast because, yeah, it sounds like other things that I enjoy listening to. And like you said, just kind of diving into these little historical bits and design sounds fun. Scavenger's Reign is now like the winner. Well, actually, it probably was technically winning. It's been mentioned 3 times, in 29 episodes. First person that brought it up, if I'm not mistaken, was Eric Slauson. So Eric
Okay.
designed like Monstrosity and a
Yeah,
bunch of other kind of
I know
party
it.
games. And then I had next the next person that I think it was literally like before I even had the next episode released or Eric's episode released, I talked to John Perry, like Air Land & Sea and a whole bunch of other games and everything. And he brought it up too. So I honestly, yeah, I think it was like back to back if I'm not
I think we kind of feel like it's. I suspect it. A little people who like the game, the TV series rather. We know it's under the radar. In fact, they didn't get renewed for a new season. And so maybe we're all a bit more fervent about it. But I remember because I hadn't heard about it either. And somebody, you know, it seems like it's completely word of mouth, basically. So we kind of feel like do our bit to kind of continue on the love, I guess.
Yeah, I think I finally finished up at like the beginning of November, 'cause I watched it like immediately, like
Oh, I see.
right,
Okay, yeah.
yeah, like right after Eric recommended it. I'm like, I'm gonna watch it, and I loved it, but I just don't watch a ton of TV by myself, so I kind of like fell away, and then I carved out the time. I'm like, okay, I'm halfway done with it. Like, I'm gonna watch the second half, and I'm very glad that I did. So yeah, I've been trying to recommend it to friends and throwing in like group chats, like, hey, watch it, but I agree. Okay, so then the final question is, we mentioned 52 Realms, so that project just finished up, and then those files will get distributed to the backers pretty soon, and
Yeah, later
then
this week.
okay, later this week, very soon, yeah, before, well, yeah, so that'll be really quickly, and then I guess just kind of like a quick question before getting to that, how quickly do you typically wind up then making the game available on Postmark after kind of like that initial delivery?
Yeah, it really, we don't have a hard and set rule. I think it just depends on it's the workload. You know, obviously it's a matter of work to fulfill the game initially. It usually happens somewhere, you know, 2 to 4 weeks after it goes to backers, it'll go on the website. In this particular instance, because we're kind of over Christmas, it will probably be like kind of mid-January because we'll all take a break over the holidays. So yeah, there is a bit of an advantage if you back it on the Kickstarter. You still get it a little bit earlier, but we're not, you know, we don't try and keep it off the website. It's purely practical. We're not trying to like delay it. It just takes a bit of time basically to get all that all set up.
Makes a ton of sense. So, well, basically, though, nonetheless, if you missed it, you're not going to have to wait
No, you're
super
not gonna have
long.
to wait too long. No, you're not gonna have to wait too long. Yeah, I apologize. Yeah, we sort of intentionally run these campaigns, at least for the backers, so they can get them before Christmas. And that's why we're really pushing, you know, because we sort of think maybe this Friday is most people's last day at work if they work in an office, if they're going to print it out of the office, which a lot of people do. So, yeah, we're trying to really get it ready, so those folks can do that and have it ready before Christmas.
Yeah. And then I've just kind of like being on your Board Game Geek page, I know that there are some designs that I saw for 2025, if I'm not mistaken, at least more than one. Anything that you kind of want to like shout out or have people be on the lookout for from you there? Obviously, like I said, you just keep designing, so it's probably a lot, but
Well, it's always I'm not yeah I should be a lot, as I said, not good at the self-promotion, so I should be a bit more prepared. One that does come to mind is a game called Builders of Baldur's Gate, which is a Dungeons and Dragons official themed game with WizKids, and that should be released I think in April, although it might be a little bit later. But I know it's open for pre-order anyway, and they've got some images and things up. That was a lot of fun. They kind of approached me. It's my first time working. Recently, I've got to really work with a couple of big IPs. I had a Minecraft game, a small Minecraft card game come out early this year. That was also Ravnica coming to me. So that's a bit of a new experience for me and one I enjoyed, you know, quite a bit. So I'm kind of excited to see how that might be received around things. So that's one thing. And I don't think I have anything else coming out like really. I mean, I'm probably wrong, but yeah, nothing else really comes to mind. I'll have a few games later in 2025, but they haven't been announced yet. So and this is where I should tell people to buy. Oh, the only thing I would other say, if anyone's listening, check out, we've just recently released the second box of Perspectives. So Perspectives is a narrative game. If I can give you another person to talk to next, is Dave Neil, also part of the Cambridge Group and an amazing narrative game designer, maybe best known for making the most recent box of the Sherlock Holmes consulting detective game. We worked together on that game, and I really love what we've done. And yeah, we've just released the second box, which they're completely a bit like Unlock. Each box comes with three scenarios. I just really recommend checking it out. If you haven't heard about it, there's plenty of reviews out from the first box so you can get an idea of how the game plays. But it's a really fun, very collaborative narrative game. I'd say more collaborative than most narrative games in that you effectively it's almost a communication game. It's how do you best share the information you have with the other players under a little bit of restriction. and how do you kind of come together to kind of get the right theory to sort of solve the mystery?
Awesome. Yeah, definitely I've seen that one, and I'll look into it more. And I, speaking of things that were just released, or at least just released for me, I've got my box of Happy Home back there
Oh, good.
too. So that was something that you and Brett designed, and I
Yeah.
think that's like a pretty recent
No,
one
that's true.
too.
That kind of came out at Essen. Yeah, no, that you're right. You're right. I get a bit mixed up with times and dates and yeah, no, I should probably talk about the games that are just out. I mean, obviously Next Stage in Paris came out this year as well and things. So yeah, but look up my games, play them if you want. It's
That's good
also
stuff.
fine. Buy other people's games if you want. No worries.
By like if you're listening to this in a couple months, there might be like five more entries on your Board Game Geek page. I mean, that's just kind of the
Well,
way.
I'm not that quick, I try, but to
It
be
well,
honest.
it definitely feels that way to me. So,
Oh, thank you.
well, thank you so much for taking your time to chat with me about a whole bunch of different things. It's an absolute blast. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. No, thanks very much, Ryan.
Intertextual Cardboard Experience, the most prequely podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for choosing to spend your time here. Any further support, such as sharing the show with friends, following the page's socials in the episode description, writing a review, filling out the feedback form, or doing anything else you can think of is greatly appreciated. Keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.